Welcome to the Michelle Meow Show. John, that was another great show. I always love doing shows with you.
I do too. It's fun. And this one is a meaty discussion that we really get into. It talks generations. It talks different politics. I think it has a lot to either provoke you or to make you wistful for those grand old days of the revolutionary year.
Well, it's the title of the book, and we had the author on, Martin Duberman, and the book is called Has the Gay Rights Movement Failed? It's a big question, and I think everybody has their own answer, but let's just get to the interview, and you could hear from it. We went all over the place. Welcome to the Michelle Meow Show, your A through Z, covering the LGBT, LMNOP, and everyone in between. It's Thursday, so you know what that means. We're here at the Commonwealth Club with the beautiful view and the very beautiful John Zipper.
One of those is true.
John, thanks so much for joining us here as our co-host, and always thanks so much for the Commonwealth Club for having us here and being inclusive of LGBTQ thought leaders. That's what the show is all about. Our special guest today is by phone. We're very grateful that he's taken the time out of his afternoon to speak with us. He's professor and historian Dr. Martin Duberman, and he's got a new book out, Has the Gay Movement Failed? I mean, the title in itself perked my ears, my eyes, my interests, and I was intrigued right then and there. This is a question that I haven't asked, you know, verbatim in those words, has the gay movement failed? But I have been asking, where are we, the movement, the gay rights movement, as it applies to right now, the political challenges that we're facing? All right, let's start with this question. I mean, because it was kind of a question that is in the back of my mind. But for you, what made you want to write this book?
Well, it's been a long time since my discontent with the movement and its direction began. I was very active in the early years of the movement, way back in the early 1970s. And it seems to me that at that point, the gay movement had what I would call a radical agenda. Since then, that agenda has slowly disintegrated, and we've now become a movement that I think is accurately described as utterly mainstream. We're asking to be assimilated into a society that many of us who identify as radical or liberal do not consider a just society. And we're dismayed that the movement to which we gave so much time, energy, and hope seems to have betrayed itself.
Dr. Duberman, maybe a good point right now would be to define what you mean by the movement, because I think different people will kind of define and include different people and different groups within it. So when you talk about the movement, who are you referring to and what groups?
Okay, well, in the early years, immediately after the Stonewall riots, the group that was most prominent was the Gay Liberation Front, GLF. Soon after that, the Gay Activists Alliance arose, and those were the two major configurations. By the mid-70s, we had the National Gay Task Force, subsequently re-entitled the National Lesbian and Gay Task Force, which it should have been from the beginning, and that's how we know it today. If we jump up to the present day, the most prominent of the organizations is the Human Rights Campaign. Though the task force still exists, Lambda Legal Defense, which also initiated in the, mid-70s. And there are a number of other organizations. There are also, of course, all kinds of local organizations. And in fact, to the extent the current movement could be called radical still, that's to be found pretty much only on the local level. Groups like Song, the Audre Lorde Project, Fierce,
right,
the Sylvia Rivera Law Review, etc. I don't mean Law Review, I mean Law Project.
Yeah. I want to take us back and just kind of walk us through the timeline, because the book does start. It starts off by talking about GLF and some of these organizations, either loose or officially organized, before we get to HRC. I mean, HRC, we could talk for hours about HRC and you know, their contributions to our movement today. But going back, I think you do a great point in talking about just kind of the issues that we stood upon back then. Yes, as LGBTQ people, we more than likely were more radical in our, you know, social positions, say, for example, war, capitalism. We probably stood more for unions and labor organizing, those types of issues. I mean,
well, also race and gender were highlights of the early GLF movement.
I see race. So, for example, you did talk about race, and I had always thought from my readings that race had always been a problem in our movement to begin with, and I think that that coincides with the history of, you know, what racial inequality is in America in general. It doesn't surprise me today, if we were going to talk about the movement and be very specific about something like race, that we would, you're right, like we haven't done enough in what we thought we would do back in the 70s where we're at today. But I guess what I'm trying to say is, I'd like for you, Professor, to kind of talk about how maybe our political ideologies have shifted, because you also throw in marriage equality, and that seemed to be what, in your words or through the book, that seemed to be kind of when things started to shift for the LGBTQ community.
Yeah, I think going back roughly 15 to 20 years, well, actually, it would be more coherent, I think, if I go back even further. What happened during the 1970s, at least in my reading, is that the country as a whole faced an increasing economic depression, and many people who had devoted a lot of time to political activism simply had to hold back or withdraw because they were literally trying to put food on the table, and they had no extra time available for political work. Also, you see the same thing happening in the feminist movement during those years. It's almost exactly the same years, by which I mean from 1969 to 1972, roughly, both the gay and the feminist movements were at the high watermark of their radicalism. But subsequently, both movements simultaneously began to drift toward the center. And all the reasons that go into that, I think, are complex and would probably take more time than we have. But what is very clear is that in the last 15 to 20 years, the gay agenda has been overtaken almost entirely by the two issues of gay marriage and gays serving openly in the military. And to me, that development is highly regrettable. In the early years of the movement, far from asking permission to kill, quote, the enemy on an equal basis, people were arguing against American imperialism and against war. So the positions have been all but completely reversed. marriage, too, in the early years, there was considerable scorn of the idea of lifetime monogamous pair bonding. Those were considered bourgeois notions and institutions. And we viewed ourselves as radical outsiders determined on a complete renovation of these old-fashioned notions and institutions. So those of us who still identify as radical are not at all happy with the turn of events. Now what we're asking for essentially and have been for the last 20 years is please let us in. We are really just like you, so there's no reason to keep us out except for this insignificant matter of sexual orientation. And that whole stance of we're just folks, I find appalling. First of all, we're not just folks. We have a different history. We have a history of oppression. The result is we have a whole different set, but in important ways we have a different set of values and perspectives on institutions like marriage and the family. And those values and perspectives are not important for us, not only important for us to hold on to, but also important for mainstream America, heterosexual America, to hear about and learn from. But that kind of missionary zeal, you know, has long since departed from the movement, along with the principles that we once stood for.
Can I ask, I mean, is it a little unfair to take the gay movement to task for this when what you're really talking about was, or at least I think what we really saw in the country, was pretty much radical groups across of any type in the country from the late 60s to the early 70s. I mean, that was a time when you had a flourishing of radical groups. And those of all either shifted to the center or grown and become more mainstream or whatever. I mean, the country is not what it was in 1970. Is it really fair to take HRC and gay marriage to task for that?
Our topic of the day, at least as I understood it, was to talk about the gay movement and why I, for one, think it has failed. That is, when measured against its initial agenda. You're quite right, of course. That whole ethos, that whole liberatory spirit, which characterized the country from the mid-60s to the early 70s, that has largely disappeared, no matter where we look. At the gay movement or anywhere in the culture. But as I said earlier, and I guess should stress more, is that this new generation that's coming up now, both gay and straight and everything in between, is where I do find considerable hope that something like the original agenda of both feminism and the gay movement will finally find adherence again, because everywhere you look in the country, for example, the resistance to the Trump administration is being staffed, not exclusively, but largely by people in their 20s and their 30s. So, you know, while I'm unhappy about what's happened to the agenda of the gay movement, I certainly haven't given up all hope that this country is going to see another reversal, only this time back in the direction of renovating these institutions and these ancient inequities relating to race, gender, and class.
Dr. Dumerman, I'd like to draw on your own personal experiences. I mean, you know, you're in your mid-80s, and a lot of what you're talking about, you have your personal experiences as well. And so to kind of ask that question of the original agenda, that I think if we start from there as well, it'd be a better understanding. Because for me, I got to read the book, and I understood from what the original agenda was, we were a lot more open about being radical. And now with marriage equality, with those, or, you know, the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, being able to serve in the military, being a part of mainstream, our radical agenda may not be as obvious as it once was, I guess, in the 70s. Let's talk about that original agenda. I mean, you had covered some of the topics, but, you know, for example, you talked about how Gay Liberation Front members had radically protested the American Psychiatric Association, which then got the APA to turn back on the idea that, you know, homosexuality was an illness. Are we saying that, you know, we're just not doing radical things like that anymore? Do we need to be more radical in our strategy today, like chaining ourselves to the White House, or you know, even protesting against our own, such as Democratic candidates who say we support marriage equality, but they're not doing enough? Maybe that's what we're trying to get at. Maybe that's what you're trying to say.
Well, some of us don't support mm-hmm. marriage equality. I don't want to get us off on a tangent in terms of what you're interested in, but I guess I'm not really clear what it is specifically that you're asking me.
Well, I think you call yourself a radical liberal, and radical liberal for someone who, you know, has been there 20, 30 years ago versus someone today. I think today they call themselves democratic socialists or Bernie-crats or whatever you want, whatever the media is trending or hashtagging for folks who have a much more radical agenda. So I'm just trying to pull, you know, context and compare. Maybe a lot of what you're saying is I think our ideals are still there. The radical opinions are localized, as you opened up with. There are more nonprofit organizations or grassroots organizations who are doing the work versus a quote-unquote national movement like HRC. But I think there's more of these grassroots organizations that, you know, we're just not necessarily talking about or not making it into the news.
Well, again, all I can say in response is that if anyone thinks that issues relating to race and class have been resolved in this country, is living in a dream world. The poverty line in this country currently is $24,000 a year for a family of four. And the last figures I saw, something like 45 million Americans are living at or below the poverty line. And the percentage of people of color who fall into that category is far higher than the percentage in the population at large. The inequities that profoundly characterize our culture currently are not only deeply entrenched, but they are expanding. One problem, the only problem I see really, a significant one, with these local radical groups is that, and some of this may be that I simply don't know enough about them, but I would be, you know, I think what's needed currently is no longer single issue politics like gay rights. What we need is a coalition of people. I don't care what they call themselves. They don't have to call themselves radical, but at least people who are aware of these deep inequities in our society and how much suffering is going on in the country among vast swatches of the population. If we would somehow, nobody really knows how, but we should at least be talking about this now, and we're not. But if somehow we could combine our forces, those of us who are on the outs, whether because of sexual orientation or economic inequity or because we're trans people, or gender nonconformists in general, if somehow we could combine our forces, we would have much greater leverage in terms of not only passing the kind of legislation that would meet our goals, but really and substantially shifting the direction of the country.
When does folk, I mean, issues of obviously income inequality have indeed been, you know, front and center in the news for a number of years now, especially for those of us here in California. But also issues of, you know, racial inequity, racial violence, violence against African-American men in particular. I guess I'm maybe putting up a bit of a kind of a devil's advocate thing. I'd be interested to see what you have to say. A lot of times when you bring up these issues and you really get people talking about them, they don't turn around and vote for the radical left viewpoint. Sometimes they vote for Donald Trump. They vote for a demagogue who, you know, says he'll solve these things. How do you get, whether they go by a term radical or not, but how do people of a radical viewpoint communicate to that wider group of people who are not radicals, would never consider themselves radicals, but you need their votes in order to get to the point where you can legislate stuff? How do you make that connection?
That's an awfully good question, and I wish I had an answer for it. I don't. One major problem, I think, is that, and I write about this in the book, those who do call themselves lefties, they're on the left, there are any number of groups, I'm using this as an example of how difficult it is to answer your question, because it's so hard to find ways of mobilizing these groups so that they work together. The fact is that on the left, and this is true historically as well, on the, quote, heterosexual left, there is, I am convinced, a profound, if unacknowledged, homophobia that is alive and well. In writing that book, I read a lot of the recent literature that's emerging, books by young self-described radicals who are themselves self-described as being straight. And when they talk about, they do talk about coalitions among the oppressed, but they almost always either fail to mention or certainly, even if they mention, they fail to dwell on the potential contribution that might be made by gay radicals to this coalition, or the gay community as a whole, because it isn't only gay radicals who have a somewhat different perspective on issues like marriage and the family and friendship and monogamy and so forth. So, you know, one unacknowledged problem in trying to form a viable coalition is that homophobia, alas, is not only alive and well in the population at large, but I'm afraid it's also alive, though largely unacknowledged, by those who describe themselves as on the left. Take a publication like Jacobin, for example, which is the hip hot new left wing publication, which I dutifully read, and not only was there rarely a mention of gay people, but there was rarely a mention of feminists. It was like both issues were not considered relevant to the new left, today's new left, which is primarily focused on economic issues. And God knows economic issues need our attention desperately. Mm. But economic issues are not the only issues,
right,
that require our addressing them, you know, just as quickly as we can.
Yeah, and we've talked about it a lot here in the program, and I think the point of bringing in fresh voices is that a lot of these issues that we're concerned about today are intersectional. Professor, before we open it up to our audience for questions, I want to say this. I acknowledge that the book makes a lot of great points that definitely spoke to me. I think if you were to ask me, as the gay rights movement failed, I couldn't answer that question from a general perspective, but I think parts of it did fail. I mean, when you had a very small group of folks who started out and were members of GLF, and they were all cisgender, white, gay men who started it, I would imagine that even if their agenda were inclusive of issues like economics or race, that they couldn't possibly be as inclusive as they could be if even black gay men didn't feel comfortable in joining GLF and a lot of these organizations that started out even throughout our entire history up until now. And I think where we're at today, and you make this point at the end of the book, is that a lot of us who are addressing the inequalities that may have been a part of the agenda years before are kind of writing our own pathways today. For example, Black Lives Matter was started by queer black people or women, right? I think the founders are two out of the three.
Yeah.
Even those leading the anti-gun violence movement, one young person from Parkland, shooting, Emma Gonzalez, is a bi Latinx woman.
Yes.
I think we're writing those, and it may not be the movement in itself. But I think you're also saying that. I want to get to the part where you do talk about being hopeful with the younger generation.
Okay. You want to talk about that?
Well, what I was trying to do was support your point. And I just gave you, just what the book is about. Because with the audience here, and I did get a chance to read through it this weekend, I wanted to make sure that people understood that it wasn't just answering this question through the title, "Has the Gay Rights Movement Failed?" I wanted to give some perspective even for myself. Like, it's a very general question. There are certain parts of it that definitely has failed, but we are, in my opinion, at the very end, in being the hopeful part, we are moving in the right direction, that the movement may not be this big general thing anymore, and that there are plenty of us in the community who may not have been a part of the first initial stages of our movement are now creating the movement for ourselves, especially queer people of color, especially women in the LGBTQ community. And I should actually say transgender. The transgender community is absolutely a part of the movement today in driving the radical agenda.
Yeah, I mean, I hardly know where to start, but
yeah. Well, the book, I bet, is going to trigger different things for very different people. I think many of us, especially as you get older in age and you've been there for the women's rights movement, you've been there for the civil rights movement, the gay rights movement, that question, has the gay rights movement in itself, is going to have a very different meaning for every single person. That's what I'm trying to say. I'm not trying to say that you, as a professor, historian, someone who has, you know, gone through all the experiences all these years, are trying to answer that for us. I think you just bring up this question in which we're examining ourselves right now in this very politically challenging time.
I would just focus that more, if I may,
yeah,
on what is your take on the younger folks these days, and are they a continuation of this mainstreaming movement, or do you see like the Emma Gonzalez's and the Black Lives Matter as a course of hope for getting a little bit closer to what you want?
Well, I think there are a lot of different trends that are happening simultaneously. I think there's a real split between the national LGBTQ organizations like the Human Rights Campaign and what's going on the ground, as it were, with groups like Song in Atlanta. Song is, without question, you know, deeply engaged with movements of race and class. But what I'm writing about is primarily, though I do deal with the local issues, but I'm primarily writing about what's happened to our national organizations. They are utterly mainstream. They are devoted to gaining greater access to the society as it currently exists. They are not devoting their energies to changing that society, and especially not in regard to racial and class inequalities. So without denying the promise of what's happening on the ground with groups like Song, not only do I appreciate their work, but such hope as I still have resides wholly in their work. But the fact is that these national organizations, I mean, the last time, this may now be way off, but the number, I mean, the annual budget of the Human Rights Campaign, the last I heard, is something like $20 million.
That's almost what I make every year.
What that means, not, whereas Song is, you know, barely able to support a small staff.
Yeah.
What that in turn signifies, I hate to say it, and I hate even more to believe it, but I think what that signifies is that the Human Rights Campaign does, in its limited agenda, represent what the large majority of gay people in this country want. They wanted exactly what the agenda was: the ability to serve openly in the military and to have the state sanction their relationships through marriage. If you look at it through that filter, it's a very discouraging picture, because where does this $20 million or whatever the hell it is come from? I mean, I'm sure some of it comes from foundations and from corporations, but I think a lot of it comes from gay people themselves. And I'm not hearing any protest from HRC's constituency about its agenda.
Yeah, HRC has some wealthy donors.
There's
about five of them. Yeah. No, I appreciated the book in kind of calling out HRC again. Like, I could spend an hour talking about HRC. Where is the money going? And I'd felt, you know, and I'm 36, so I don't have a lot of experience. But when HRC came into the movement itself, hadn't really actually felt like HRC spoke for me, but I understood them to be a force to be reckoned with when it came to the fight for something like, yes, marriage. Let's open it up to our audience for questions.
Okay. Dr. Duberman, I'm not 36. I'm more in your age range. but something you said a couple of times.
I didn't hear that.
I said, I'm in your age range. So
okay, welcome.
We have some stuff in common. I do have a question, however, because a couple of times you mentioned something about marriage equality as though that were not to be desired. Does that signal to me that you oppose marriage, monogamy?
You make it sound like a major sin.
You interpret it however you wish.
Whether or not lifetime monogamous pair bonding is the ideal social and sexual arrangement depends on your view of human nature. And we could argue about that, you know, for eons and still not resolve it. Most of the reading that I've done suggests that not only is monogamy not natural to human beings, but there are almost no known species where monogamy is the dominant pattern. Bruce Badgermill wrote a book, it's now probably 10 years old, demonstrating quite conclusively that though orangutans are monogamous, the vast majority of primate species are not, and we are primates. I leave you to draw the conclusion.
Tell us a bit, we've been talking about where the movement went. Tell us a bit, especially for our younger audience members, the movement when you would think it was at its peak, when it was, or at least as close to functioning, you know, the way you would have wanted it to. I assume it was in that period of late 60s, early 70s. Tell us about some of the ways it did things, the ways that it tried to tackle these broader issues, and give us a sense of what you're saying was lost.
There was a great deal of conflict within GLF about these issues. I didn't mean to suggest, and maybe I did, that, you know, GLF was wholly unified in its demand for racial and gender equality. Far from it. I mean, the women who were involved in GLF were fighting an ongoing battle that was never resolved with the gay men in GLF. Some of the gay men acknowledged that their feminist consciousness was not what it could be, and the men themselves formed consciousness-raising groups in order to talk about their own sexism and in order to try to modify it. But there were plenty of men in GLF who scorned all of that, who did believe in the gender binary, who did believe that men were born for leadership and women were born for domestic servitude. And the same is true of race. There were very, very few black people in GLF. I don't think, I've never read anything, I should say, that explains that satisfactorily, because in fact GLF was pro Black Panthers. So it gets really complicated, because there were enough people conscious of race within GLF so that they had moved toward a radical solution to racial problems. For black people who were not attracted to the Black Panthers and there were vast numbers, they considered the Black Panthers misguided, both in their tactics and in their overall analysis. So, you know, life was not easy and smooth within GLF. There was constant controversy.
Mm-hmm.
And a number of the lesbians in the organization finally left, and they formed Radical Lesbians, a whole separate organization.
I'll be more clear in my questions. Like, I just had so many thoughts after reading the book, but you make some really great points, Professor. If we were to ask, you know, the movement to join in on all these issues that we want to prioritize, like economic inequality, race, gender, what would need to happen? I mean, how would we get, if HRC is our national organization that can be the face of our movement, what would they need to do? I mean, they currently have campaigns out that are asking for the $5, you know, here and there to support them in fighting against transgender bathroom bills. They have campaigns that suggest that they care about immigrants in this country. But yet we still have that question of, well, what has the gay movement done, I guess, when it comes to this issue in today's time, outside of calling attention to the president and his policies?
I think the activities of HRC in relation to issues like immigration is a quite recent phenomenon, and has followed only because their standing agenda of many years, the dual plank marriage and the military, has won. So with all that money and all that staff, the next question is, what do we do now? And I don't mean to say either that there aren't people connected to HRC who don't care passionately about issues relating to race and economics and class and gender. Of course there are. I'm talking about the dominant tone of the organization down to the present day, though in the present day, I agree with you, some of the literature that's coming out from HRC and some of the suggested new programs do point in what I at least would call a more progressive direction.
Would you prefer to see a new national organization of some sort, or one of these more radical local organizations maybe grow into a new national organization? Do you think that's a more tenable or a more realistic way of addressing your concerns than HRC moving in your direction, perhaps?
We get back, I think, to the problem of the general populace. I mean, if we look at earlier social movements in this country, movements for social justice, a familiar pattern does emerge. I mean, just to cite a couple of examples to explain what I mean, if we look at the anti-slavery movement in the mid-19th century, that movement was started by the so-called abolitionists, like William Lloyd Garrison and Wendell Phillips. These were people whose platform was slavery must be ended now, not tomorrow, not in the distant future, now. And it has to be ended without any compensation to slave owners. In other words, a decidedly militant platform. Then we ask the question, well, how did it end up? How were the slaves finally freed? They were freed because of Abraham Lincoln deciding to reprovision Fort Sumter in 1861. in the interim period from the 1830s to the 1861, the abolitionists were attacked in the North, not in the South. Of course, they were attacked in the South, too, but I mean, the North was also complicit. William Lloyd Garrison was dragged through a street by a mob and almost hanged from a lamppost. In other words, they were too radical for their society. I mean, take another movement. Take feminism. Again, mid-19th century, the Seneca Falls Conference. The agenda that the women at Seneca Falls, like Susan B. Anthony, came up with was a much more radical agenda than what turned into the suffragettes 50 years later, their demand for the vote. They narrowed the whole platform down to a single issue, the vote. And what happened to slavery? Same thing. They narrowed the issue down to no further extension of slavery. That accounted for the birth of the Republican Party. That was its chief plank, no further extension. But they guaranteed not to touch slavery where it already existed. And there were huge chunks of land south of the Mason-Dixon line where slavery was going to be still free to expand. What I'm getting at in giving these historical examples is that time and time again in this country, a passionate visionary movement will arise, and its adherents will be only a small number of the population, though a very militant and devoted group. But over and over again, their initial radical programs get watered down. And who knows, if it hadn't been for a civil war breaking out, we don't know how far south slavery would have expanded. We don't know if even today we would not have some form of indentured servitude. Some people would argue, in fact, we do have it. Anyway, hopefully my point is clear. We come back over and over again to the essentially conservative nature of our culture.
Thank you. And that's kind of where I was trying to get you.
Passionately radical and want to make lives of many people less difficult, but over and over again, they are unable to reach a substantial constituency. And so their initial platforms get watered down. And so what eventually comes out represents some improvement in the status. Slavery will not be further extended, but doesn't get rid of the institution. It doesn't get rid, in other words, of the root problem.
That's exactly what I was trying to get at in this hour, is to talk about that. And while we're winding down on time, I mean, you know, what I want to pick out in the book and what I saw as a failure is what comes to my mind, what I'm personally I'm worried about is that, yes, we've made some huge gains in our movement. And as one of our audience members said, me being able to do this show is part of the success of our movement. At the same time, some things that I think that we haven't been able to address, and we definitely need to, is that the complacency or some of it, the attitudes of complacency with where we're at, when you have issues like religious liberty and these policies start to enact over certain states and it gives people the ability to use religious liberty or religious freedom in order to discriminate. I mean, how as a movement are we then going to come together again after marriage equality to argue that that is in fact discrimination, as more and more people are thinking about religious freedom as, or I'm sorry, as gay rights, if they're still thinking about it from a second-class citizenship attitude. And what I mean by that is, from the social perspective, somebody could say, I support LGBTQ people. I have LGBTQ friends, and you know, and they are part of America, and I look at them like they have rights like I do. But at the same time, when it comes to religion, I can also understand that if somebody were to say, because you know of what the Bible says, I should be able to turn somebody away. So I think what I'm trying to say is that what the book does at least is give us some pause. It gives us a moment to think about how do we shape, you know, the questions and the next opportunities that will be discriminated upon. And if it goes further than just marriage, how do we get to a place where we can get everybody together again to argue against these types of issues? That's kind of where my mind went, is that there are very specific small things that I don't think we're necessarily paying attention to. Because if you have the big organizations like HRC stand and say, this is discrimination, and that's all we are saying, what about the folks in a lot of other states who really, you know, who have religion, who have, you know what? Today is one of those days where I woke up and I was doing way too many reading for too many people. But Martin, what I'm getting at is, it was a great book, and you bring up some things that I think we all can look at ourselves in the mirror and ask, where are we in the movement? That's where I was trying to get at.
Well, thanks. I think I know where you're coming from, and what I'm left with is worry that a lot of gay people really feel the battle is over. That, you know, you pointed to, you know, I have gay friends and I have no problem with someone's sexuality. It's their life, let them do what they want. And so, I mean, we do hear those kinds of things all the time now. But what isn't happening, at least I don't think so, what isn't happening is that what we as gay people have to contribute to the mainstream is really not being listened to. It's not being incorporated. And we do have certain quite unique insights. Outsiders always have very special insights into mainstream culture that mainstreamers themselves don't have about themselves. But the problem seems to me that all these liberal folks who are saying, no, that's old hat. I mean, we're fine with gay people. We have no problem. I mean, you know, a gay couple was over for dinner just last week. That's not good enough.
Mm-hmm.
What did they talk about?
Yeah, that's exactly what I was trying to say. There's also
really
complacency with our allies, you know, and that has a lot to do with media. If you don't really truly understand kind of the way things work, I know John's giving me a certain look.
Only because I think I don't want to sell short the many straight allies who and such who. Who are pastors who've been performing same-sex marriages, sorry, but they've been, you know, even when it could result in them, and often did, result in them losing their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who, the parents who have stood up for their gay and lesbian and trans kids long before it became, you know, the thing to do. This is not a...
Absolutely. Yeah,
I mean, there actually has been progress made in society. I do think what you've really put a... your thumb on the fact that the lure of the radical solution has dissipated, and I think it's continued. To be honest, and I do not define myself as a radical, but I've been kind of paying attention to this over my lifetime, and I'm in between you and Michelle, that, you know, it's, I kind of would have thought that you talked about kind of impossible swing back in a radical direction. I kind of thought that would have happened before now. And I expected it at various times. And instead, it just kind of keep it, it really kind of supports your description of our society as kind of like, you know, fundamentally conservative in that sense, because it does seem that swing hasn't happened, you know, since the early 70s. And I'm not sure when it will.
And I guess I don't mean like allies and your community, your friends. I mean, as in our political leaders.
We've got more out lesbians and gays and increasingly transgender people than ever. Mind you, I'm not saying, oh my God, everything's great. I'm saying it is different from what it was in 1979.
It is very different, but political leaders, who once, if they didn't support marriage equality, that was one of the things that they were afraid about, because if they didn't support marriage equality, they didn't get certain endorsements, they didn't get certain cash funding. Hold on. So political leaders, and I'm talking about that, I think that we should continue to put pressure on, and I'm talking about those of us who are, so-called Democrats who are in big positions of power, people who are CEOs, people who have, yes, exorbitant amount of wealth, who say they're for LGBTQ rights, just kind of are. I guess what I'm trying to say is, you when you get to a place where you think you've already done it all, you've done enough, and you're making change within your community, what happens when the next big thing is starting to happen? And my fear is that the next big thing is this big policy that gives people out a reason to discriminate. And that's based off of religion, which in a lot of states in America, outside of California and New York, there's a lot of people that can get behind saying, I actually don't think there are all that many people.
What I want to say will seem to come from out of the blue. But hopefully I can make it relevant. While you both were talking, what popped into my head was, please forgive me, I'll try to make sense of this. What popped into my head was the Weimar Republic.
Oh, yeah.
Germany in the 1920s. What was going on in Germany in the 1920s was that the prosperous element, at least in the Jewish population, was very self-congratulatory. They felt that they had been all but fully accepted into the mainstream culture of the Republic. They were prospering. They were holding down, in some cases, a point of office. Walter Rathenau, a Jew, was prime minister of Germany at the time. And when Nazism began its rise, it was widely felt in the Jewish world of Germany that this is a temporary aberration. We are thoroughly integrated into the culture. They're not going to turn on their own citizens. I think therein lies a cautionary lesson. Mm-hmm. That we do not become too complacent about the actual depth of the acceptance of gay people in this country, let alone elsewhere in the world. I mean, we're talking about our country, but let's not forget that the plight of gay people elsewhere in the world is dismally worse than it is here. What I'm saying, though, relates to what's going on here. And I'm asking that we not be very complacent in the face of this new acceptance, because I think not far below the surface of that lies the same old homophobia that we used to have to cope with when it was expressing itself in a far more overt way.
Martin, I want to thank you so much for joining us here on the program. We've ran out of time, but I want to give John, because I love John, some final thoughts. But we'll say thank you and goodbye to you. And the book, if you're interested in reading it, is Has the Gay Movement Failed by Martin Duberman.
Out now?
Yeah, it is out. Yes, it's available. John.
I really didn't have anything to add.
I cut you off, and I love doing this show with you.
I thought Dr. Duberman had the great wrap up there. So.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining the Michelle Meow Show. This will air 4 o'clock Pacific Standard Time on Progressive Voices Network. We'll be back next week at the Commonwealth Club. For everything else, you can head to michellemeow.com. Thanks for joining us for the Michelle Meow Show, your A through Z covering the LGBT, LMNOP, and everyone in between. We're here every Thursday live at the Commonwealth Club, and you can listen to past shows at
commonwealthclub.org/MMS.